Hey everybody, welcome to Rock and Roll Shinsu Chew. This is episode number 123, where we present the Chew-ins, the class of 2025. Every year, we hold the Chew-in Hall of Fame inductions, which are intended to recognize artists that are unlikely to be enshrined into the actual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But we feel these artists are equally deserving of the recognition. This year, Levi is going to induct the Outlaws, Jonathan's going to induct Broken Social Scene, and I will induct Cinderella. My name is Gabe Estel. I'm here with my co-hosts, Dennis Levi Leach and Jonathan Goetz. How's it going, guys?
It's going pretty good.
It's good to be back. It's been too long. We need to meet more frequently. This is our first episode of 2025, and I'm excited to be here with you guys. One of my favorite times of the year, the Chew-ins. Now, this is often provoked. Well, I should say it's always provoked. We usually get the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We get their they send, you know, out their press release of their inductions list, and then, you know, a few weeks later the nominees are selected. And that, you know, that's when we say it's time to do the Chew-ins. Over the years, we've recognized a lot of different artists. When we share info about this episode, I'll share some links and tidbits about other artists we've inducted. And just to tell everybody a little bit about the criteria, it's pretty loose criteria, but these are folks that are, like I said in the intro, unlikely, maybe not totally impossible, but unlikely to be inducted into the actual Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But there's something special about these artists. They were influential, or they were popular, or we just think more people need to know about them and they deserve the recognition. So, before we get into our individual selections, we're going to go ahead and talk about the 2025 inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland. And guys, maybe it's just a sign that we're getting old. We're getting bands now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame where their first album came out, you know, when we were basically in adolescence, right? For several of these artists. This year, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees are Bad Company, Chubby Checker, Joe Cocker, Cyndi Lauper, Outkast, Soundgarden, and the White Stripes. Guys, let's break these down. Where do you want to begin? Or do we just want to kind of bitch about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for a few minutes?
Either way is fine. Whatever you
want. Well, let me start off, Levi. Then we'll get. I'll hand the microphone to Levi to go down to the artist. Let me just a couple things. Right, I think the reason that we established this chew-in was because we have. I don't want to speak for both of you, but I think I can here. All three of us have some ambivalence around the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Is that safe to say, guys?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't take it personally.
Yeah.
Yes, right. I mean, meaning that the spirit of rock and roll is about rebellion, and even the notion of a Hall of Fame for something like rock and roll seems kind of antithetical to the spirit of rock and roll. You know what I mean?
Right. When, you know, it's hard for them. It's not like any of the other sports where we have categories and stats.
You got numbers.
Then be like, yeah, it's like, hey, oh, obviously that guy should be in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You would think they could use record sales to do that, but they do not.
They don't. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. If it was based on record sales, the Ramones wouldn't be in there and the Bay City Rollers would. Okay. Like, I mean, you can't just do record sales. I mean, it's so subjective. You know, I mean, like, art, right. It's art. It's subjective. But yeah, anyway.
Absolutely. And what's the gentleman who started Rolling Stone?
Oh,
Jan Wenner.
Yeah.
Basically, this was, I think, started originally as his just kind of like pet project. And then, like, it formed to be like a cool club. It's like, okay, like, if you were ever cool with Rolling Stone in the past, like, right, you could be eligible to be in. Oh, but you were one of the pricks that didn't give good interviews or let us do that photo spread that we wanted. Like, it turned into that, I think, for a while.
It's this gatekeeper mentality, you know? Absolutely. Like, who deems what's cool? You know, the age old question, right? Who gets to define cool, right?
Yeah.
For one guy, Radiohead is cool. For the next person, Poison is cool.
Right.
For the next person, Chaka Khan is cool. I happen to think all three of those artists are awesome. Okay. And they all three deserve to be in. But other people, you know, it's just, I don't like it. It's fun to see the collaborations, you know, like the musical performances of the evening. You know, a lot of times the people who are nominated will get together, the people that nominated them or did their induction speech will come out. You know, the Pearl Jam thing from, gosh, almost 10 years ago now was great. I enjoyed that a lot. Always wanted to see Neil Schon and Trevor Rabin play with Pearl Jam, right? But that's really, to me, about the only good part of it all, you know? It's just
right. Yeah. I mean, to start it off this year, the first three nominees or inductees, I should say, they're no longer nominees. Bad Company, Chubby Checker, and Joe Cocker just feel like it's more of the last few years, which is them playing catch up. Like, these are people that probably should have obviously been in by now. You're telling me Chubby Checker should have been in like 92 or something, like when they were
putting first 20 artists
putting all those early rock dudes in. So it's like, how did they miss that guy?
Yeah.
And then, you know, Joe Cocker and Bad Company, this more of the same. Like, they were two of the biggest artists of their eras.
Mm-hmm.
So that's I like Cyndi Lauper, and I'm glad that she's there, and it's good that they're getting more 80s acts in. And if that's what it takes to help, like, kick in the door to get some more 80s acts in, like, Men at Work should probably be in there.
Sure.
If Cyndi Lauper is in there, I'm good with that. Even though, don't get me wrong, and I don't want the hate mail to come, I only own two Cyndi Lauper records. She's So Unusual and True Colors. Like, can you name two other famous Cyndi Lauper records besides those two?
I think that's fair, because you have to look at a body of work. You know what I mean?
But
the Rock Hall doesn't always do that. You know, they don't look at the whole body.
I'm totally fine though with Cyndi. I love Cyndi Lauper. I have her records. I'm surrounded by her music. But I'm happy that they've turned the page now to where we're getting 90s acts. So, you know, Outkast, Soundgarden, and White Stripes, I'm definitely down for. And if this is what it takes to get Meg White, like, out of seclusion, no, you're getting a word. You have to come.
I don't think they've ever nominated or inducted anyone who doesn't deserve it. You know, I mean, maybe that's just me thinking the whole institution's largely bullshit anyway. No. But
yeah.
But like, I mean, all these people deserve the accolades, you know, all the nominees, even the people that didn't make it in this year deserve the accolades.
I think what happens when you have little private clubs like this, like you said, once you do add in certain acts or people, then it just begs the question of, well, then why aren't these other people then?
Exactly.
If this guy's in there now, or this girl,
just exists to generate arguments. You know what I mean? It was about honoring the artist. Now it's just like, what can we argue about? Let's turn the comments section into real life. You know?
And I mean, I'm looking forward to hopefully Outkast performs.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. And you know, it's.
Yeah, be curious to see what they do. You know, who honors who inducts Soundgarden,
and
you
so
know,
like
what,
in these
what
last,
songs they play. Yeah,
these last couple of years, they've like switched it all up. We had kind of touched this post or pre-recording, where everything is divided now into categories. So those acts we just mentioned were all part of the performer category of the inductees, and so now there's these other two subcategories, Musical Influence Awards and Musical Excellence Awards. And so I am not positive, but from what I have read online, I don't think it's the same as like the normal Rock and Roll Hall of Fame statue that the other performer inductees get.
It's some type of special category. No, it doesn't. I get the impression, like, you know, it's further down the website if you have to scroll to find Salt-N-Pepa and Warren Zevon, which is a travesty because both those artists are awesome.
Right. So I'm not sure. Hopefully, like, it's not one of those situations where they're not kind of on the same level ground at the hall.
Yeah. You mentioned Levi. Yeah,
they definitely deserve it. Salt and Pepper and Warren Zevon. And then the three musical excellence award. I'm very happy they added this. Yeah. Like this category needed to be added like 15 years ago. Cause there's a ton of these unsung guys in the music business and in the studio world that need the acclaim. Nicky Hopkins, Tom Bell, and Carole Kaye are on so many records. It's not even funny, you know?
Yeah.
So they absolutely deserve that. And I'm happy for that.
Is that the Intercontinental championship belt to be inducted under that category?
Yeah. You can make the argument that it's the honky tonk man
my money saw Carole Kaye, man. She swings a big bass.
Yeah. I'll say this, you know, Levi mentioned that they're catching up with some people, you know, older artists that, you know, were overlooked. They got a lot of catching up to do, in my opinion, with hip hop and metal. I think that they're getting better about it, but really beyond like Sabbath and Metallica, they haven't really touched heavy metal, you know. Hip hop, you know, they did some of the kind of pioneers like the Grandmaster Flash and you know, LL Cool J and you know, they've nominated some other folks in recent years, but there's so many great, you know, rappers that aren't in there, you know, people like Rakim. You know, I don't think Tribe Called Quest is in, to my knowledge. You know, like, so there's always somebody they're going to overlook, and that's where we come in, folks. Yeah. Rock and Roll Shinsu Chu is here to the rescue. And I say the Chew-ins are really the institution that matters here, folks. You know, DJ Quick may never get a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, although I hope he does. John Hammond may never get a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. I hope he does. Grand Funk Railroad may never get a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, but I hope they do. But you know what? You can find all three of those artists in the Chew-ins. All right. And that's what we're going to be doing tonight. Getz, anything to add to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees, the folks that got in this year?
Just that I think that the prolific nature is de-emphasized of artists post 1990 in that Outkast, Soundgarden, and White Stripes released 18 albums combined. Joe Cocker released 22 albums, albums.
Right.
And I love Soundgarden. They're in my top 10 favorite bands of all time. But if Soundgarden existed in the 1970s, they would not be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That's a good point.
And I think that the Rock Hall is appeasing people our age with Soundgarden and the White Stripes. That's probably not to diminish their contribution, but it is to remove the wool that's been pulled over our eyes a bit in this conversation.
What year was Pearl Jam?
26.
Several years ago. Yeah.
I think Levi, I always say that because I watch that Rockin' in the Free World fairly frequently. just because I'm like, look at who's on stage, dude. Yeah, I think it's 2016. They got in the same year Yes did.
So 9 years to Soundgarden. So in 9 years, do we get Alice in Chains?
Yeah, Chains probably gets
on Temple Pilots.
Chains has fewer albums. But yeah, I mean, Soundgarden had 6 albums, White Stripes had 6, Outkast had 6. The bar is lowered in terms of productivity. And that's not to say that productivity matters.
Out of the few, like just boom, on the fly, Alice in Chains or STP, who gets in the Rock Hall first?
I think STP should get in first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do, and I'm a bigger Alice in Chains fan, and I think STP should get him first.
I don't know. I don't know, man. That's impossible for me to answer. Really.
I think that the DeLeo brothers are probably the most underrated songwriters of the last 25 years. 30 years.
I respect that take. I do. I don't know, man. Levi, that's a tough one.
Jerry Cantrell is also an underrated songwriter of the last 30 years.
So. Yeah, I tend to think...
And the only reason I pose it that way, guys, is it's like, if we're only getting one every 9 years, I'm like, which one's the, you know...
Mudhoney.
hold a knife to my neck, you know, and I've got to pick one. I guess if you boil it down that way, I'll go with Alice in Chains just because it's totally personal. And I just think the quality of the output is better, and that's no knock on STP. I think their first three records are all brilliant, particularly the first two. But to me, I don't really think Alice in Chains has put out, a lackluster album, and I think some of those later STP works are kind of ho-hum personally, but
I think they're underrated, but you know, there's no wrong answer, but yet the test is bunk.
Yeah,
I agree with, so yeah, mediator that made you guys do that.
Yeah,
I'll throw it in. I think I agree a little bit with both of you. Like, I think those later STP albums are underrated, and the reason why I think some people may not connect with them as much as because those first few albums were so stellar.
Sure. Yeah.
Like those first three albums or four, like the first three for sure. But I like four a lot too. A lot of people, that was when some of the diehard STP guys fell off, but like I connected with four.
Yeah.
A lot.
Me too.
So, I see both of your, and that's, you know, my problem. I see both sides.
Yeah, it's great. It's all great.
I love Outkast. I have to admit, like, again, if I'm forced to, I think there are other hip hop artists that deserve to be in well before they do.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, they're fantastic.
Pardon my ignorance, are they the first Southern rap act in the Rock Hall now?
Might be. Yeah. I mean, they were.
I'm wondering if they felt like a kind of a need to get a nod towards that era and style of hip hop.
Just because, you know, over the last 20 years, Atlanta's been the rap capital of the United States. You know what I mean? Like, it used to be the East Coast and the West Coast, and it is now 110% Atlanta is where popular hip hop is made. And it has been that way for a while now. So you might be right there, Levi. I don't know. Offhand, if they are the first Southern rap group to be inducted, but speaking of Southern rap, they ought to put Ghetto Boys in there, as far as I'm concerned. But let me say one last thing, guys, before we move on to our choices. You know, it may not list everything that artist has done, like they just nominated one. Like, I kind of wonder sometimes too. And Levi, this kind of goes back to, I think, a point you made earlier. I don't remember exactly what you were saying, but it was a recognition thing. They might be honoring, you know, only one name gets in, but it might be honoring the work that they've done outside of that group too. Like, for instance, let me give you an example. NWA got in a few years ago, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they put out, you know, one of the best hip hop albums ever made. You know, but small body of work just for NWA. Right. It's two LPs and an EP, you know, granted, like the first LP's probably one of the most influential hip hop albums of all time. So I'm kind of wondering, it's like, did they also honor Dre's solo work and Ice Cube's solo work and Eazy-E's solo work without inducting them separately? You know what I mean? If it was just like a swoop thing. Right. And I say that because I look at this year and, I love Bad Company. They got great songs, but I think Free's a better band.
Yeah, I would. Hopefully, Paul wears a Free shirt or something like on stage.
Well, Simon Kirk will get in too, you know, because he moved over.
Yeah, I guess it kind of is.
But you know, let me put it this way: Bad Company may have better songs, but I think Free's a better band, and I think Free's far more influential than Bad Company. You listen to a lot of guitarists that we like; they'll tell you Paul Kossoff is a huge influence on them, and he is. I don't know. We could do a whole cost of that underrated guitar.
We should do something like a whole Free to Bad Company thing, because it's like, in my mind, Free was like raw, rough power.
Yep.
And Bad Company was like someone took that and like put it in a rock polisher.
Yeah, they polished Free. Yeah. Bad Company is like, polished Free. Yeah, it's slicker production.
Yeah,
kind of tighter songs. Whereas you know, Free's a blues band. You know, or a blues rock band.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, Bad Company's got more piano and stuff. You know, I mean, it's great. I love them both.
It's slicker, but they both work really well.
I'm
glad we have both.
Really cool to see. I'll say this, you know, if a good thing comes out of this year, and I mean, they're all worthy. You know, Paul Rodgers is a great vocalist. I think just maybe people talking about him more as one of the great rock frontmen, I think, is a good thing that'll come out of this year's class. You know, he's just awesome stage presence, good writer. You know, just I think Paul Rodgers is quite underrated. So happy to see, you know, sort of him get the, while he's still alive, you know, to get that recognition, I think is cool.
So the band with the maybe the least amount of productivity to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame
for Bad Company. Yeah, right. Good point. Yeah, one LP there.
One LP.
Right, one LP. And I've said this before, Getz. As much as I love Guns N' Roses, and as influential as Appetite for Destruction is, not a big body of work there either.
No,
They got in shortly after they were eligible.
Yep. And it really wasn't a question too.
Yeah,
right.
No.
Like you're like, oh yeah, of course. Like, yeah, of course. You know, they've only released like three albums or whatever, but four albums.
Yeah. Four albums and an album of covers and an EP lies.
Yeah.
You know,
but it was never a question.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's all up for debate, but we feel like tonight, folks, we are giving you three that we are happy to enshrine here in the as the latest crop of chew-ins. Levi, can I start with you? We're going to take it to the South, as you mentioned, with Outkast. And I don't know if Outkast and the Outlaws have ever been mentioned in the same sentence, but folks, this is why you have to listen to this podcast. Who the fuck else is going to talk about Brosham Social Scene and Cinderella in the same episode? Just us. I guarantee you there are a lot of podcasts out there, but we are the only fuckers who do this. Okay. I love you both. Levi, kick it off.
Well, yeah, man. The Outlaws emerged in Tampa, Florida in the late 1960s, like 67, I think is... With a lot of Southern rock, you will learn that a lot of the dates and times are fuzzy with a lot of the former
bands.
That's
the lore.
So, yes. Late 60s, and like right away, guys are already coming and going. You know, normal cliche reasons like I'm going off to college or I'm getting married or I'm got to grow up or whatever. But like they were already turning over guys. But in 1971, they gelled with a lineup that featured Huey Thomason, Henry Paul, Billy Jones, Monty Yoho, and Frank O'Keefe. They quickly gained popularity in the Tampa Bay area and began touring the Southeast, and they were known by fans and radio DJs as the Florida Guitar Army, because during the middle of the jams, the three guitarists and the bass player would all stand at the front of the stage.
Oh, yeah.
So the band's unique blend of country and rock, coupled with their powerful live performances, and also while opening for Lynyrd Skynyrd, they were able to catch the eye of Clive Davis, who caught them opening for Skynyrd, and Ronnie Van Zant apparently told him that if you don't sign the Outlaws, you're the dumbest music man I've ever met in the business, and I know you're not dumb. And so I guess that worked, and Clive Davis signed him basically on the spot. And that was when Clive Davis had just left Columbia and was starting Arista Records. And so that they were his first rock act. Mm-hmm. And so in 1975, their debut self-titled album featured the two hits, There Goes Another Love Song and Green Grass and High Tides. They were major hits. The album went gold very, very quickly. And it launched them to national fame, maybe too quickly. Two more well-received albums, pretty much consecutively, Lady in Waiting and Hurry Sundown, capitalized on the same formulas, kind of the same thing. Great music. All of their albums at that time were really tight and cohesive, and all of their playing and the singing and everything is like, that's the prime, in my mind, prime Outlaws is the first three albums. But after that third album and that consecutively third tour, so at that time in the music business, it's album tour, album tour, album tour, album tour, album tour, album tour, album tour. And so they were caught up in that cycle, and the band was starting to crack. Henry Paul, one of the guitarists, the third guitarist, I guess, if you wanted to say, originally within the band, he was kind of like the leader or almost front man and like kind of like the musical director within the band. And so after the first three albums and with those first two huge radio hits off that self-titled album, they were sang by Huey. Mm-hmm. And so Huey and Billy kind of get it in their mind that the band is like theirs now, kind of, after the third album. And so apparently, you know, on top of all of this, I forgot to mention, is lots of drugs and alcohol. It's the 70s.
Yes.
And so, you know, they kind of got caught up in it. And, you know, Huey and Billy got caught up in that. And they basically, it just came to a point and they kicked Henry and Frank, the bass player, out of the band. And at that point, Frank, I guess, on the road, wasn't able to keep it together. Like the shows were getting bad, and so they were dismissed, and Henry Paul took it really, really hard, but he immediately formed another just group right away called the Henry Paul Band, who then got a record deal and had a small hit called Grey Ghost. But the Outlaws with Huey and Billy in a reformed group of what turned to become a revolving door of members, they soldiered on. More albums followed, including in 1980, the album Ghost Riders, which ended up containing their biggest last radio hit, Ghost Riders in the Sky. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, they just couldn't keep the magic going. Lots and lots more personnel changes, including Henry Paul even coming back. Like the Henry Paul Band kind of fizzled after its record deal failed. And then he came back, but it wasn't enough. At that point, you know, it was pretty much the death of Southern rock in the mid-80s, late 80s. And so Henry Paul leaves to then form the country band Blackhawk in 1992, which had some success on country radio and CMT at that time. I don't know if you guys remembered them at all. They were on the radio, but in around that same time, Huey was offered the position to be the third guitarist in Lynyrd Skynyrd. And so Huey took his guitar for hire and went for about 10 years. He toured with them up until 2007 when he passed away at home from a heart attack, just like in between tour breaks. You know, bittersweet the band's output kind of is, but the first three albums, I think, are worthy of another evaluation and a little more in-depth talk. Like, a lot of Southern rock bands had three guitar attacks, but that wasn't their trademark just alone, the Outlaws. What helped propel them to the masses, what may have been like their secret sauce to an extent, is they had amazing three and four part vocal harmonies, which definitely let them stand out from their Southern rock contemporaries and other acts of that time. Which I, you know, I said Southern rock, Greg Allman would kill me or smack me if he was here, because I guess Greg Allman hated that term, Southern rock.
Yeah.
He said rock and roll is born in the South. He said, that's redundant. That's like saying rock, rock.
Well, when I get to my nominee, I'll talk a little bit about nomenclature as well. That's a good point. Yeah, you know, it's all rock and roll.
Their harmony vocals, they collided at a time in 1975, which also collided with the advent of, it's called the effects oral exciter. And so what it was an effect that was created and started to use around that time. And what it does is it adds the basic way to, I guess, explain it would be it adds like a sparkle or like a perceived dynamics to what you put it on. And so originally guys were using it on vocals a lot. And so when you listen back, now that I've mentioned all this to everyone and you guys out there, listen to some of those Outlaw records. And then also you can listen to some of the early Alabama records from the 80s. They were well known for using those oral exciters on their vocals as well. And I mean, don't get me wrong, they weren't like auto tunes or it's nothing like that. It's just an effect that I don't know how to explain it. Once you hear it, you'll be like, oh, that's an exciter. You can hear it once you know what you're listening for. And so they definitely add to the sound of the Outlaws and the act Alabama. You know what I mean? That band sold millions and millions of records with that. But the problem was that effect kind of got overused and guys would sometimes start using it on like not just the vocals, like let's record the album and then master it and put some exciter on the whole thing. And so it kind of got, you know, became a cliche to use it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the biggest takeaway from doing my deep research kind of was doing about the band was that it seemed like once Henry Paul left the band, once they kind of kicked him out, it seemed like the band leader, the shepherd or whatever you want to call it was gone. And the later output definitely suffers, I think, sure, without him there. And so, you know, after Huey passed, though, Henry Paul and Monty, the original drummer from 75 in those first three, or I forget how many albums Monty was on, but they continue to tour to this day sometimes as the Outlaws, as well as Blackhawk, because Monty was the drummer in Blackhawk. So it's kind of like two guys, two different bands. they tour sometimes, you know.
No, yeah. With some veteran acts, you get into that territory where there's spinoffs and, you know, one member has one version of the band and another. And you kind of hate to see that.
These guys, Monty and Henry Paul, are the only two alive members left.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know, is Monty still there? Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Well, I don't know if Monty is still touring. He was up until just the last few years, I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, great points, man. And I've always loved these guys. I want to say like maybe about 20 years ago, what really turned me on to them I got like a bootleg, you know, I was getting a Black Crow show and somebody chipped it in, or if I got it off Wolfgang's Vault, I can't remember, of a live show of theirs from like 75 or 76. And they jam, you know, it kind of reminded me of, Jonathan turned me on to, you know, Jonathan, you gave me a bootleg of the Marshall Tucker Band like 20 some years ago. And, I knew the radio songs, and I appreciated those for what they were, you know, the studio version, whatever. And I didn't know how much they jammed live, you know, and I think you probably gave me that bootleg at a time when I was like probably really into bands that jam, you know, I still am, but you know. The jam band years, so to speak. And, you know, I felt some of that same with the Outlaws when I got those couple bootlegs from them. from 75, 76. They're definitely Levi, you know, in when he mentioned how tight the studio albums are, and they are, they're really tight. They're great songs too on those first three albums in particular. Like you mentioned, Levi, They really tear it up live. I recommend somebody go to YouTube and look at and listen to any of their live shows from the 70s or as we know, you know, every big 70s artist has the double live, right? The classic double live LP. Yeah. Their double live is from 78. It's called Bringing It Back Alive. And I know a few of the cuts were recorded here in Chicago at the Aragon. Really underrated double live album from the 70s.
Yeah, I got that.
They had Freddie Salem playing with them then.
Right.
Well, who's a really good stars too. Yeah.
I don't want anyone to think like I was ragging on them about like revolving door comments. Yeah. Like that's just life on the road when you're in like a touring band.
Sure.
And sometimes you can't keep the five guys together for that long. And I mean, if you want to keep the music alive, that's just what you do.
The Greengrass and High Tides on that Bringing It Back Alive is like 20 minutes.
That's excellent. I picked that up on CD. I was excited when I found it too, because it's not a common album that you see on vinyl or CD that often.
Yeah, really good band. I'll add a couple other points to it, and then Getz, if you want to say anything about the Outlaws, but we did a Southern Rock episode several years ago, and I'll share a link to it, you know, when we promote this episode, and we talked a little bit about the Outlaws that night, I remember. It's a shame that they're not mentioned in the same breath as the Allman Brothers and Lynyrd Skynyrd and Marshall Tucker Band. Not to say that maybe they have the stature of those bands, but I think if I had to make a Mount Rushmore of 70s bands from the South that typically, right or wrong, get categorized as Southern rock, they would be my fourth choice. You know, I would say the Allman, Skynyrd, and Marshall Tucker Band and the Outlaws, who I think all four of them are quite different. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
Marshall Tucker and the Allmans have a very big jazz influence on them. You know, Outlaws have some of that too. Although the Outlaws, I think, are maybe the poppiest of those four. You know, pop being a relative term there.
Yeah.
And Skynyrd just being Skynyrd, and original Skynyrd is just, that's a thousand. They don't have a bad song from the 70s. So yeah, they're on that, you know. They're not, a lot of people, I think, you know who those three bands are, but they don't know who the Outlaws are probably. Not a lot of people, at least. They might know Greengrass and High Tides from the radio a little bit. So there's that. And then also, you know, all four of those bands that I just mentioned, really just all marked by tragedy. You know, whether it was plane crashes, motorcycle crashes, suicides, you know, drugs and alcohol, obviously, which comes with the territory. All of those bands have been touched by tragedy. All of them. I mean, you know, just it's pretty heartbreaking there. And you know, I won't get into all the tragedies. You can look them up, but yeah, it's they've all experienced a lot of loss. All four of those bands. Yeah. And my last point, Levi, you know, you were talking about, you know, kind of, you know, that last album of theirs, Ghostwriter, or not the last album, but the last kind of album to maybe chart or get attention, mainstream attention, was Ghostwriters in the Sky.
Yeah,
I kind of feel like their sound was polished enough that maybe, I'm not necessarily advocating for, but maybe if they got with the right producer and you look at an act that kind of like had a comeback in the 80s, like a 38 Special, or maybe even a poppier kind of like Rossington Collins Band had that sound kind of, I think maybe with the right producer and maybe even, dare I say, a little bit of country tinge, I think they could have found some success in the 80s if maybe a few different moves were made. You know what I mean? Maybe the promotion behind them, obviously, as well. You know, maybe getting kind of adopted by Nashville a little bit. I think it could have worked. I mean, commercially.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, some acts were able to kind of do that and make that transition. It's a shame that they weren't, you know. Again, it's sad that I think drugs and alcohol played a big part in the demise of that band, to so many bands. But, like, in doing the research, it seemed like you know, as soon as maybe something might gel, somebody would leave, you know, somebody'd have a drug problem and have to leave. Yep. And somebody else, you know, revolving door, next guy, next man up mentality. And don't get me wrong. Like you said, the live shows, I don't feel like suffered a ton on the live shows I've seen. And on YouTube, yeah, there's a ton of live clips, you know.
Yeah, there's a really good one from New Jersey in 78. Yeah,
the Capitol Theater stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Rips.
There's a ton of great clips on YouTube at the Capitol Theater. I feel like I should have maybe built a time machine and moved to New Jersey or something, because
Capitol Theater is a great venue. I mean, yeah. And it's well, no, isn't there's one in Port Chester, New York, too, I think. Okay. I think there's two Capitol Theaters. Maybe they might be, I don't know. Anyway.
I want to say, yeah, the Outlaws one was the New Jersey one.
I think you're right. Yeah. So Getz, I mean, anything Getz, I know you're a big fan, obviously, of the Allman Brothers and Marshall Tucker Band and Leonard Skinner, original Leonard Skinner. You've kind of gotten tuned into the Outlaws a little bit, right?
Yeah, man, it's really easy to enjoy them. You know, guitar harmonies, vocal harmonies. You're missing out if you're into the Allmans and Marshall Tucker. Like, yeah, the Outlaws are a no-brainer.
Yeah. I, you know, if you listen to like a There Goes Another Love song live, they're just shredding. I mean, it sounds pretty effortless, those three working together, you know, those three guitarists.
They made it look so effortless, some of those videos.
Where, Billy Jones, like, was a real guitarist. You,
as a guitarist, I try to, like, I'm like, wow. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, there are no slouches. And then also, if I'm not mistaken, Levi, they have two percussionists. I mean, they have... Yeah,
two drummers. Another kind
right,
of...
Right, you know, which another kind of common thread. I'm sorry, Levi, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, I was saying the same thing you were saying. Another Southern rock staple.
Yeah, right. You know, that's what, you know, the Allmans, Tucker, and Outlaws all went with the dual percussionists. So pretty cool. Well, good choice, Levi.
No worries.
God, once we get done recording this, I'm going to go listen to them, I think, quite frankly. I'll put on Bring It Back Alive. I got it on vinyl, Levi. You'd be proud. So my copy's probably not in good a shape as yours, but I got it on vinyl. Levi Getz come over to my house. They'll look at how I keep my records and they'll probably both shit. But, anyway, Jonathan, why don't we go with you, man? Let's switch gears a little bit and go from Tampa, Florida to Canada and, talk about Broken Social Scene.
Yeah, well, before we cross the border just yet, I'll, you know, it was taking back to 2006, and I was kind of coming out of my, you know, the jam band scene a little bit. You know, it's expanding the horizons. I wasn't leaving it behind. That, you know, I grew with it throughout college and graduated and moved down to Kansas City in 04 and got Sirius Radio, you know, the before Sirius XM, it was just Sirius. They had a channel on Sirius called Left of Center. I don't know if they still have it after the merger. I don't know. I bailed on the digital radio after, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I think. And on Left of Center, there was this tune by a band called Apostle of Hustle. And it really caught my ear, and it was off of an album called National Anthem of Nowhere, and the tune was called My Sword Hand's Anger, and it was one of those I just kind of kept coming back to, and I didn't know anything about the band, and come to find out that it's actually a band that was considered a side project, but that's kind of diminishing it a little bit. It was another project related to kind of a larger project called Broken Social Scene. And so I understood that, but it took a few years for me to really get into Broken Social Scene and understand what they were all about. And so, in Toronto, in the late 90s, early 2000s, Broken Social Scene got rolling as a collective, meaning that they, you know, members came and went, and they were, all the members were encouraged to have other projects. And, you know, they, to date, they've had like more than like 27 members, more than two dozen members, up to about 10 to 15 members concurrently, just ducking in and out, you know. They had a core, including like Kevin Drew and Brendan Canning and Andrew Whiteman, who's in Apostle of Hustle as well. And most notable members include like Leslie Feist, who had the hit, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 that was on the iPod Nano commercial way back in the day, about, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so I slowly grew to appreciate one album, their third album, self-titled album. And it was one of those where it was a summer that I just like kept spinning it and spinning it and spinning it. And I grew to appreciate it in a way that, you know, I hadn't really appreciated music on that was, you know, it was pretty raw and ambient. And, you know, their first album is all instrumental. And yeah. And their second album is where they started to gain some traction because it got a big review from Pitchfork and launched them. And but for me, it's this third album, the self-titled album, that I particularly grew attached to. And I started to understand that this, you know, they proved that there's like this proof of concept that, you know, a true collective could produce consistently great work with a cohesive sound that consistently sounded and felt fresh. And, you know, they dropping the egos and labels that were so common in rock and roll. It was almost, you know, standard fare for you know, everybody to be very, I guess monogamous, for lack of a better word, when it came to a band. And then, like, you know, you get three or four albums under your belt and maybe one of the members would go off and produce a solo album on their own, or maybe the singer would do something on their own. But this is just like, this is the just the rule of the band, is that you're also doing these other things. And and if you look at the tree that this that Broken Social Scene is attached to, that is a part of, it goes on and on and on. And my introduction to them through Apostle of Hustle was just one branch of that. And so it was very encouraging that this exploration of other projects and this totally different mindset. So really guitar driven music, psychedelic at times, indie pop. It's also called like Baroque pop. And there's a lot of unfinished edges in it, so you can hear the creative process in at the beginning of recordings, at the end of recordings. You know, they leave in a lot of the, you know, hey, when one of the singers is speaking to the producer in the middle of a take, say, that often that stuff is like, it would never be included, but they include a lot of that just so you can hear that creative process. So the second and third albums, though, both won the Alt Album of the Year in Canada for the what are called the Juno Awards in Canada. Yeah. So, yeah, their second and third albums both won. Even Geddy Lee appears in a video for a tune called Fire Eyed Boy.
That's when you know you really made it in Canada.
Right? Right? Yeah. You know, this the indie darlings weren't so indie that they didn't want to have Geddy Lee in a video. You know, the band would produce solo albums that were, you know, called Broken Social Scene Presents. And it would be, you know, one of the singers, Kevin Drew, and another one, Brendan Canning. Tom Cochran appears on this Kevin Drew album, Canadian legend. Yes. Tom Cochran.
Have they ever worked with Burton Cummings and Randy Bachman? Okay.
Like, yeah, I know. It's overdue. It is definitely overdue. just the five studio albums over 5 years, or I'm sorry, over 25 years, including an EP, dual EPs that basically create a sixth studio album. And in my opinion, the band gets better and better. And even their most recent output is some of my favorite output. They're going to have a documentary released. Actually, it's already been released. It's kind of have this slow rollout of theaters throughout the country over the summer months, which I'm super excited for. It's going to be in Lawrence, Kansas in a couple weeks. It'll even be in Kansas City soon thereafter. It's called It's All Gonna Break, which is from a song on my favorite album of theirs, which I was just reading the liner notes and for this album, and they have great notes for each song, just like little bullet points for each song, and like they were mid recording bullet points. And for It's All Gonna Break, there is a bullet point for it to sound like Bob Seger, but on acid. And and I think that that does touch upon the approach of this band. And there's a lot of guitars. So if you like guitars, I highly recommend it. And but at the same time, it has a lot of indie cachet. And I think that there's something for everybody. And there's something new for me, at least on every listen. And I hope you guys, you know, when you dipped in and out of it, got a bit of the same.
For sure, man. I'm looking actually to dive into more. I was only able to really get into some of You Forgot It and People, the second album. But I liked it. And some of my favorite was kind of the ambient instrumental stuff. So I'm looking forward to going back to that first album more. Do you know, like, so, like, I guess five albums, 25 years, an album every 5 years. Does each, like, tour consist of the people from that album, like, for 5 years? Or, like, how does that aspect of the band work? Do you know any?
I couldn't say for certain, but my impression is it's that whoever's available, they don't care.
Okay. Like, first man like, up. Get them in.
Yeah, man. If you can be on the album, that's great. If you can be on the tour, that's great. But like, it's my impression that it's kind of no pressure to an extent. Okay. And you know, you do what you got to do, and you do what you got to do for your other projects as well.
That's cool. It's really cool, Getz, and it's a good choice. And I had to revisit them. You know, I remember the only album of theirs I'm really familiar with is the self-titled one from 05, the one you referenced earlier. I remember the wife being really into them around that time, and Feist as well. I did not know, you know, some of the offshoot projects. Like, I knew the offshoot projects, but I have to admit, I didn't know they were connected to Broken Social Scene, like Stars and Metric. Two bands that I have heard. I've seen Metric live, actually. And I had no idea that Metric was a branch on that tree, so to speak. It's cool.
Yeah, Emily Haynes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's cool, man. It's like the 70s. You know what I mean? It's like you know, a band, and you've got offshoots of a band, and they get together, and it's a good vibe, man. It's in like Levi said, it made me want to explore the category more, because the only, I want to say maybe I had Stephanie or my wife or I had the 2005 record. I know that. Mm-hmm. But this was nice, because it was something I hadn't tuned into in quite a while. So
really good stuff. Yeah, you know, and like I said, 25 years later, they're still, you know, kind of getting it done. And if they aren't doing that project, you know, they're probably doing something else, and you can find them out active doing something else. And I've been fortunate. I've caught them once. I caught them once at the live at the Pageant in St. Louis in 2017. And that was a pretty tumultuous time in St. Louis.
And that was around the the police. Right. Yeah.
A lot of social unrest and they read the room. And at that time they were closing shows with It's All Gonna Break, which is, you know, on its face, a pretty destructive sounding song. And it's literally a kind of destructive sounding song at times, you know, at moments in the song. But they say, you know, we've been closing every show with that on this tour, but we get that there's like, you know, these are pretty sensitive times here in St. Louis. And so they took the show in another direction at the end, and it almost got like kind of transcendental, and it was pretty cool. You know, it was, I think, really appreciated by the local crowd.
It's cool to see a band, you know, be aware of its surroundings like that, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff, man. I really dug it. And I, like Levi was saying, that, you know, the ambient stuff, I was not that familiar with the first album, that is, right, very ambient. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
the vocals are minimal on there. Minimal vocals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always like a multi-vocalist band, too. You know, it always works. Give me a Gomez, you know what I mean, in that regard. Yeah. They've got that going for them, which I always like, obviously, with 48 members, you can kind of pluck somebody to sing all the time. So it's good. But yeah, good choice.
It's fun. Real quick, if you search for them performing on Conan O'Brien's show, it's kind of a crappy YouTube recording, but it's entertaining nonetheless. I mean, there's dual vocalists on it, and you just like keep counting the guitars, like how many guitars are on this stage.
Yeah.
And at the end of the tune, Conan comes out. He's like, I think you guys need another guitar. I think there's like 15 people up on that stage for that performance. That's
awesome. That is great. Yeah. Good stuff, man. Good inclusion and
good for us, bad for the sound guy.
Yeah, exactly. Good luck, buddy.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, so I'll put a ribbon
take
on it.
Away.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, Levi had said, you know, Greg Allman never liked the term Southern rock, you know, just felt as though it, you know, most music, you know, the blues came from the South, et cetera. Like, it, you know, he probably took it, you know, because he made some of that music, you know, it can kind of have a derogatory sort of implication. And with the band that I'm going to nominate or that I'm going to induct tonight, I think the same could be true for the term hair metal, you know, or hair band. I have some of it's nostalgia and some of it is the opposite, is getting older and just kind of appreciating how much care people put into making music, regardless if you like the music or not. It's a lot of work. I don't like the term hair metal, guys. I don't. I think it's a slap in the face to the people that made the music. I prefer the term, and I'm not trying to be like the language police here or anything like that. So from now on, I'm going to refer to the genre tonight when I'm describing my induction as glam metal, because I think that is the kind of like the best term that you can use. You know, it's not just glam, because like, you know, T-Rex was glam, I guess. You know, David Bowie was glam. New York Dolls, right? Who I think are a big influence on this band. But yeah, you know, I like the term glam metal. And you know, for those of you out there, you would probably think of this as hair metal. I'm talking about, you know, bands like Bon Jovi and Poison and Warrant and Motley Crue and whoever else, you know, gets lumped into that category. But I've always, you know, been a lot more sympathetic, for lack of a better term, to that genre. And I feel like it never got the respect that it deserves. It's kind of turned into a joke. And I don't like that because, you know, two reasons. I think those guys worked hard on it and it's a slap in the face. And I think the second reason is sometimes you just got to write songs about having a good time. Not everybody needs to be Radiohead. You know what I mean? Like they just don't. Like my heart and brain have room for Radiohead, and they have room for, you know, the Bullet Boys as well. And what my heart has a lot of room for lately is the band I'm going to induct tonight. That is Philadelphia area's own Cinderella. I appreciate my co-host here letting me call an audible because I had another band often lumped into this category selected. But then I got listening, and I really felt like Cinderella deserved the nod. Because I do think that they stand out among a lot of the bands lumped into that glam metal category for their musical credibility. To me, Cinderella is I think they're a glam blues band, guys, is what I think Cinderella is. So Cinderella was formed, you know, in the mid-80s. They're Philadelphia area guys. You know, Philly is kind of where, you know, all those guys kind of met up. And they are, their album, their first album is called Night Songs, and it came out on June 9th of 1986. And, I believe that was the same day or right around the same time. There's like a date in, I want to say like, there's a date in 1986 where like, I want to say Slippery When Wet, Night Songs, and Poison's Look What the Cat Dragged In all came out like right at the same time, wow. Right? So Cinderella's Night Songs is their first album. If you look at the cover, obviously, right, it's, you know, you see what they're advertising there. It is a product of the era. But I think if you get away from the image and strip it down, I really think this is a great record, and they continue to make their next, well, I think all four of their records are really good. So it's led by the vocalist Tom Kiefer, who has, I think, really one of the great raspy voices of rock and roll that more people should recognize. How, you know, it's an unmistakable voice that he's got. I mean, it is some raspy shit. It is raspy on raspy, right? Even by those standards, you know, he can really rasp it up. You know, guitarist named Jeff LaBar, as well as the bass player is Eric Brittenham, and then the drummer's Fred Curry. It's really those, you know, those four guys, and they had people playing keyboards. They had a guy named Jeff Paris playing keyboards, who isn't often credited. But those four guys recorded all the first three albums from Cinderella, and those first three albums are Night Songs, Long Cold Winter, and Heartbreak Station. Now, one of the criteria I've always had for an induction is give me three great records from the band. That's, if I've got to assign criteria to my selections, that's always been it. And I think Cinderella's got it in Night Songs, Long Cold Winter, and Heartbreak Station. And Heartbreak Station was the one that I hadn't listened to in quite a while, and I'll talk a little bit about it a little bit later, but I think it's a great one. You know, Levi had mentioned, I see some parallels in our choices tonight. Levi had mentioned Ronnie Van Zant, you know, recommending the Outlaws to Clive Davis. Cinderella was actually discovered by John Bon Jovi, right? John Bon Jovi got them, another Philly area guy, Jersey guy, Philly area guy, who you know, just thought he saw something there. And he's like, wow, these guys are going to be stars if they get the right machine behind them. And he helped with that. So props to Jersey's second son. I'll give the boss the first, but Jovi as the second. So he you know, he kind of was instrumental in setting them up with their record deal. Night Songs, they're on Mercury, I believe. Yes, they're on Mercury. So Night Songs comes out, and you know, it I think it stands out as just sort of a strong inclusion in the glam metal genre. Like I said, the front cover is kind of ridiculous. You know, I think the band will probably even in retrospect tell you that. But they had a single called Shake Me, another one called Nobody's Fool, another one called Somebody Save Me. And, you know, I remember those being in heavy rotation on MTV and, you know, being into the band. I think I had Long Cold Winter on cassette. And so, you know, they really take off. The album peaked at number three in, came out in 86, but then, you know, reached number three in early 97, went double platinum, eventually triple platinum. So huge success. 2 years later, they go in to record their second album, which I think is my favorite one of theirs, which is Long Cold Winter. And I'd say in this one, as well as Heartbreak Station, the blues influence kind of shines a bit more. That kind of sets them apart from some of their contemporaries in the glam metal genre. The album reaches number 10 in the U.S., also goes double platinum, so they're on a huge hot streak here. My favorite song by Cinderella is Gypsy Road, which they rip live. It was a single off Long Cold Winter. And then another big single off Long Cold Winter is probably it's their most popular song. Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone, which is the classic glam metal ballad. I think they really excelled at writing a ballad. So Long Cold Winter also, you know, immensely successful. And then, you know, they tour behind it. Things are going well. They're hot as hell. And then they release Heartbreak Station and at the end of 19. Well, let's see. Yeah. Close to the end of 1990. Right. Heartbreak Station then comes out and, you know, it charts pretty well, you know, for the time. They're crowded out by kind of other contemporaries of the glam metal genre still when the decade turns in 1990. Heartbreak Station, I think it's even bluesier than Long Cold Winter, right? I mean, there's a lot of piano on Heartbreak Station. There's even kind of some country elements to it. If you're not familiar with this song, I suggest they got a song called Sick for the Cure, which has become one of my favorite Cinderella songs in recent years. And then kind of the big single from Heartbreak Station is a song called Shelter Me, which is definitely like just a boot stomping, you know, just rousing kind of reminds me of like an up-tempo Salt of the Earth by the Rolling Stones. You know, it's got that feel to it. And they also just, you know, they've got some good social commentary in it as well. And then, you know, we all know, you know, 1991 is definitely a groundbreaking year for music. And while that 1991 may have been great for Nirvana, it was not as kind to Cinderella. They toured, you know, Heartbreak Station, you know, successful tour, went to Japan. And there's a good New Year's Eve show from 1990 out there that they released as an official bootleg. Check it out. And then 1991 hits, and they're kind of marked by two tragedies, right? First one is Tom Kiefer loses his voice. Like, you know, the guy just thinks it's, you know, just from, you know, straining his voice all those years. Obviously, he's a very raspy singer. He really pours his guts out into it. But it turns out that, right, it's more than that. He's got paralysis of his left vocal cord, right, in 1991, and he's really got to work intensely with vocal coaches to get his voice back. And you know, you couple that tragedy with, you know, the arrival of Seattle onto the scene, you know, with Pearl Jam and Nirvana and Soundgarden and those bands. And it was a, you know, a pretty dark time for those guys. And I'd like to think, guys, if I could change anything about music, I would like Seattle and the Sunset Strip to coexist. All right. Because I love Pearl Jam. Both of you know, I've seen them both with you guys many times. One of my favorite bands. And this was not Pearl Jam or Nirvana or Soundgarden's intentions, but from a marketing angle and from an MTV angle and just the fickleness of the public, it almost really killed those guys overnight, you know?
You it's know, crazy. Cinderella. If you think about it just a little bit, it was like a repeat of what happened with the 70s artists to the transition to the 80s decade.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people, and I, you would think maybe some of those artists in the 80s would have had a little foresight to be like, oh man, at the turn of the decade, all those 70s guys fell on their faces, and none of them had the foresight to even think that.
There, you know, there's a few that survived that, you know, that transitioned well. You know, your ZZ Top, Genesis, yes, you know, they did it.
Yeah.
I think for those guys, what came in was all so much different.
Yeah.
They just really couldn't transition and still look authentic, you know, and try and be true to themselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, Tom loses his voice, and it takes a lot of work to get it back to record now. I mean, you know, they can't tour, you know. Popularity is waning anyway. So in 1994, they finally get an album together. They don't have Fred Curry on drums. They've got Kenny Aronoff, who's a great session player.
Yeah.
You know, played with Fogerty, Mellencamp. You know, plays with Sammy Hagar now, I think. Just a really famous session guy. He's great. So he's on drums for it. So they released in 1994, still under Mercury. So I'm guessing like it's one of those things like they're still under contract, right? Even though musical trends are
still owed.
Mercury's like, we got to release this. Mercury like gave it, I think, like zero promotion, you know what I mean? Or not much. And I read a little tidbit that Cinderella's A&R guy, when Still Climbing was released in 1994. And it is still a glam metal album. You know, it's still true to Cinderella's sound. You know, they're not trying to sound like fucking Alice in Chains on it or anything. You know what I mean? I think they knew what their strengths were and where their roots lie. You know, you saw some bands kind of do that, you know, try to kind of, I don't know, grunge up the sound, for lack of a better term, you know, and it just didn't work. They never tried to do that. You know, they put out kind of, you know, glittery blues like they always had. And it just, you know, in 1994, that's just not going to find the same audience, you know, of size that you did just 3-4 years earlier. So I read a little tidbit where their A&R guy, you know, from Mercury or something, called MTV, you know, Still Climbing was coming out. They were getting ready to shoot videos and everything. And MTV just flat out told them, we don't play music like that anymore. You know, I mean, you guys imagine to hear that? That's, you know, if you're the artist that's making that, that's devastating shit to hear, you know?
Right, because they were, at the time, the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
They were MTV.
Yeah, right. And again, you know, I love all of those bands, you know, that came out of Seattle, and they've had staying power where other genres didn't. But, you know, it is tragic that in order for one to live, another has to die, so to speak, at least in the popular eye. So 1994, basically, that's kind of it for Cinderella's studio output. You know, they got back together a few times. You know, and by that point, I think, unfortunately, and hey, you know, I'm not, unfortunate is a relative term here, because everybody's got to make a living. You know, you're doing a lot of the package chores and the cruises and the things like that, that you kind of have to do, you know, in order to have your, you know, to put food on the table. Let's be honest, it's their gig, man. You know, I don't fault anybody for playing a cruise or playing a county fair or, you know, going on tour with four other bands that you know, kind of get lumped into that category. You got a family, you do what you got to do. But so I think Cinderella is never got the recognition they deserve, because I think that there is a lot of musical credibility there that you don't see with some of their contemporaries. A band that I inducted into the Chew-Ins a few years ago, I think, kind of reminds me of Cinderella, and that's Tesla, who I think, you know, gets lumped into that category often as well. And I think a bit unfairly, or at least it diminishes their talent when, you know, Tesla gets lumped in with that. You know, Tesla's got a Southern rock influence. They've got a bluesy influence, a country influence. But, you know, most people think, oh, you know, they're like Poison, you know, or something like that. Yeah. And that's too bad. And I think in the long run, it probably hurt both Cinderella and Tesla, to be put with those. You know, Tom Kiefer, I did a little bit of research on him, looked at some interviews and things like that. And there's a pretty in-depth interview where he talks about losing his voice. And, you know, it's, it's pretty gut-wrenching to hear what that's like for a singer, where, you know, that's, you know, he plays guitar, but, you know, he's known for his raspy voice.
The little bit of research I had read about him was, like, he strained his vocal, like, his left vocal cord so bad he caused it to become paralyzed.
Yes. Yeah.
He, like, caused that's crazy that can happen. B, but then you have the mentalness of that on your brain that you did it to yourself.
Yeah, right. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's like, and so, yeah, it's just.
Yeah. He seems like a really sweet guy. You know, I mean, I don't, Gravis, I don't know him, but I've been watching several interviews over the last few nights.
Like, he's never tried to resurrect their name and, like, cash in on, like, lots of.
No, he really hasn't. You know, they're
like, always just seen him advertised as, like, the Tom Kiefer band or just Tom Kiefer.
Yeah. And while they had some other players come in and out for those reunion tours, it has largely been those four guys until. About 10 years ago, or actually not that long ago, I think it was 2021, excuse me, I misspoke. Jeff LaBar, their lead guitarist, unfortunately passed away. So Eric, the bass player, now plays in Brett Michaels' solo band, and the drummer, Fred Curry, I think he still plays around and stuff, but I'm not totally sure of what his latest projects are. But I also got to listen into Tom Kiefer's got a couple solo records with Tom Kiefer Band, and quite frankly, they're pretty solid LPs, man. You know, they were fun. They were bluesy. They were kind of foot stomping, good stuff, you know? To me, Tom Kiefer, he always reminded me, he's like David Johansen with a Les Paul. You know what I mean? That's who that guy is to me, you know? He's going to be playing, Tom Kiefer Band's going to be playing in one of the suburbs near Chicago in late August. And by God, I think I'm going to go.
Well, yeah, I'm going to have a good one.
Worth the dude, man. You know what? If you're listening to these guys, go out and see them live, man. You know, support them. So I'm glad to see him still soldier on and do it. And I got to kind of thinking about, you know, kind of how I would break down that glam metal status. I kind of made some notes here of a, if you guys will indulge me, let me indulge me for a second, a glam metal kind of status chart, right? So I think at the top of it, and this isn't in terms of like how much I like them or their quality, but I just think this is kind of how it landed. You've got Bon Jovi, Def Leppard, and Motley Crue as kind of coming away from that scene relatively unscathed. You know what I mean? Like, in the sense that they get associated with it, but they've, all three of them have always played big venues. You know, that never really dropped off their popularity, except for maybe when Motley Crue didn't have Vince Neil. But you know what I mean? Like Bon Jovi, you know, basically Bon Jovi plays like Giant Stadium and shit. You know what I mean? Like, he's huge. Def Leppard, you know, right up there as well. And Motley Crue too. You know, they never checked out of arenas, so to speak. You know what I mean? So they kind of walked away from that whole scene relatively unscathed in terms of their reputation. Then I think you've got kind of the sort of, I call them like the boy bands of the glam metal genre. And I think that's Poison, Trickster, Bullet Boys, and Warrant. And I like things about all of those bands, but they're kind of the ones that were like, you know, all of them had a good looking guy in it. You know what I mean? Like a really good looking guy. And they could kind of be marketed that way. And then I think the third category is you kind of have your 70s veterans that succumbed to the glam metal movement. And I would say that would be Kiss when they took off their makeup. Alice Cooper when he got sober, you know, and did the, you know, I'm talking about the
Thrash.
Poison. Yeah,
Thrash. You know.
Yeah. Hey Stupid and Thrash. Right. Yeah. And then I think also, you know, with Whitesnake, you know, David Coverdale being in Deep Purple. And then really kind of glossing the sound up to transition to the 80s with later Whitesnake, you know.
Yeah.
And then finally, I think you've got, to me, the three that sort of stand out for their most musical credibility. I'll just say it, of all those groups, I think you've got Cinderella, Tesla, and then I'll also, not as bluesy, but I'll also put Rat in that category because I think Rat was just the sleaziest of the bunch. And I think it works there. You know, all of these bands, kind of had three big influences to me: the New York Dolls, Kiss, and Led Zeppelin, right? Now, yes, they did not sound like all three of those bands. And the New York Dolls and Zeppelin are critically acclaimed. Kiss is widely popular, you know, is hugely popular. They're Kiss icons. But, you know, they are like those bands. They just did it a little bit differently in a different time. And I think that they deserve more recognition than they get. And I don't always think music has to say a lot to be important. And to be good, right. You know, let's be honest. It's most of the time, you know, most of it's about partying and fucking anyway, when it's all said and done, not all of it, but you know what I mean? Sure. So yeah, I felt compelled to give Cinderella their due tonight. And I hope I did. So.
No, yeah, man.
Cinderella's my choice. Movie. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's a great choice. You know, my time with Cinderella dates back to the mid 80s when they were popular, and my older brother Sean was playing them pretty regularly those first two albums. Yep. And yeah, man, listening to those, I'm taken right back. And there is something, you know, something about it where it's like Coming Home is a killer tune, like in its own right. I don't care what genre you're talking about.
Fuck genres. Great. All right. Yeah. It's all
it's
rock and roll at the end of the day.
And you know, looking at so Andy Johns produced those first two Cinderella albums, brother of Glenn Johns. And and you know, looking at Andy Johns' roster for production, you know, a few years before, he's producing television's Marquee Moon. And now tomorrow, I have to listen to Marquee Moon, followed by Night Songs, followed by Long Cold Winter.
Let's get that guy on. Let's get that guy on.
I'm going to connect the dots.
I want to talk about all that. Yeah, I want to talk about working with television and working with Cinderella.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And Joni Mitchell right in between.
Right. You know, guys, I want to say, like, you know, that Still Climbing record was released at an unfortunate time for them. It just, no matter what they did, that album wasn't going to be popular in 1994.
Yeah. Dead in the water.
Yeah. I kind of wonder, you know, if maybe you would have got them with, I don't know, maybe like a year or two before. Obviously, Tom had to lost his voice, you know, whatever musical, the shift in music wasn't as dramatic, maybe, or they were able to weather that storm a little bit better. I think maybe if you got them with like a George Trakoulias, you know, who did the first two Crows records, or maybe even throw in a, you know, as a bold choice, or like a Rick Rubin, you know, who worked with some X. I think if you would have put them maybe in like 92, 93 with a couple of those guys, I would have really liked to see what they could have cranked out. You know what I mean? Like, don't worry about MTV. We're just going to get you with a good producer here. Be yourselves 100%, you know, and but we'll still put some muscle behind it and some good production values. You know, I would really like to see that. You know, there's if you could get them somewhere between Heartbreak Station and Still Climbing with the right people, I really think that could have been something cool.
Dude, even Rick Parisher, who produced Pearl Jam's 10, it's not that different.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You know, if you go back and listen to 10 and some of the what people would call overproduction of it, it's not that different.
Right, absolutely. Hell, I'm sure MacReady likes Cinderella.
Sure.
So, really good choices tonight all around, guys. I really always enjoy this. It's a chance to really take a dive into some artists that are really deserving of all these accolades. So I thank you for your good choices tonight. The Outlaws, Broken Social Scene, and then my inclusion of Cinderella. I think we'll put a bow on it there, fellas. I had a great time tonight. I hope to do it again soon. I want to remind everybody, you can find all of our episodes at rockchew.com. I would say follow us on Twitter, but I'm going to be honest, nobody's updated that thing in quite a while. And you know, so X or whatever it is now. But we will post this on Facebook and more on Instagram. You'll find it on all your favorite podcast apps, including Spotify. And give us a like at rockchew.com. And tell all your friends, and we'll be back to see you sooner rather than later this time. So have a great night. Have a great summer. And peace out.
Peace.